With an eloquence which surprised myself, I described the confusion of a soul hurled into eternity in the heat and passion of battle with no knowledge of what lies before it on the next plane of existence. I quoted to them the solemn invocation from the Book of Common Prayer, "From battle and murder and from sudden death, good Lord, deliver us," which shows that the fathers of the early church knew more about the afterlife than their successors do today. When I had finished, their heads were put together and there was much whispering and conferring. Finally, my Lady of the Daisies lifted up her cool, clipped voice. "Are you suggesting that our brave men in the services will suffer remorse in the next life because they are killing their country's enemies?" "No, madam," I said, "they will not, because they do not know, as I know, the consequences to the souls of those they send into eternity. It is precisely because I have been given that knowledge through the exercise of my gift of mediumship that I must refuse the responsibility of taking human life. And yet you are not unwilling indirectly to help the armed forces to kill more efficiently?" This was the calm, detached voice of the president. I said my country was engaged in a war which I considered to be a struggle of good against evil, and I would play my part to my utmost, short of personally taking life. There was another whispered conference, and a quiet grey-faced man who had not hitherto spoken, looked up. "How do we know you are sincere?" he said. I approached the president and held out to him an envelope in which was the letter offering me sanctuary in America and Bunny Parsons' carbon copy of my reply. "I think these two letters will answer the gentleman's question," I said. The president read both the American letter and the copy of my reply and passed them around for the others to see. There was more whispering and more conferring, and finally the president told me I would be called into a non-combatant corps sometime in the near future. Then I was dismissed. I walked to the underground station to take the train back to Hendon and saw a great bomber's moon sailing in the sky. As I reached the station, the sound of the air raid siren wailed and the city's orchestra of defense started. On the platform, the tiered bunks were already being occupied by those who slept in them, night after night, in comparative safety. Families were claiming pitches where they would spread drugs and pillows, or were already ensconced, eating from paper bags and drinking tea from my diuresis negation asks. Here and all over the hidden depths of the city was the identical smell of fear and sweat and musty used-up air. These were Londoners, enduring with patience and humor and some small defiance. They were such good people. Walking home from Hendon Station to the concerto of guns, falling shrapnel and the shriek and crump of bombs, I worried about how to provide for Edith when I was away on war duty. I had saved over £100, which I would leave with her, and she had her own small pension, but when I thought of the rent, the rates, the heat, the light and all the other bills, which arrived with depressing regularity, I wondered how long £100 would last. How long would the war go on? My pay as a private soldier in a non-combatant unit would be 2 shillings a day, so perhaps I could squeeze 10 shillings a week to send home to Edith. I had to do something, because otherwise she would try to solve her problem by working in munitions, and she was not strong enough, nor any longer young enough, to work long hours at a factory bench. When I reached home, Edith told me that Miss Tucker and Dr. Young had called at the house while I was in London, to say they proposed to forego the rent at 31 Sydney Grove while I was on war service. My anxieties took flight, and I remembered a promise given to me long before, by one of those who guide and help me from life's other side. "You will never have all you want," he said, "but as long as you serve faithfully, you will be provided with all you need." Then I remembered how often help had come from some unexpected source when it was most needed, and I reproached myself for my lack of trust. The day came when I had to leave my home, my work and all that was dear to me. Edith came with me to London to see me off at Paddington Station, where I was to catch the next train to the coastal town of Ilfracombe. We found the train and I saw it was full of men of my own age who were all bound for Ilfracombe and the same training course as I was. Some of the men kindly moved to make a place for me in one of the crowded carriages. I leaned out of the window talking to Edith until the last second. Talk does not come easily at such a time, and all we could find to say to each other, when there was so much to be said, were banalities like "don't forget to write" and "take care of yourself." At last the train shuddered into movement, and I kissed Edith farewell as I watched her blink back tears and force a smile. The train hurried away from the platform, and I hung out of the window watching Edith wave until I lost sight of her in the distance. As the train carried me faster and faster to a new and unknown life, I felt very lonely in that crowded carriage. 9 Outside Ilfracombe station, 2 sergeants were cantering to and fro like bad-tempered sheepdogs, trying to herd us into the semblance of a column. In our civilian clothes, crumpled from the journey, clutching our little cases, we must have looked a sorry sight. "What an horrible lot," I heard one of the sergeants say. "A regular shower," agreed the other. "Hounded by these sheepdogs, we were out of step and straggling, but they marched us down the hill to our billet, which turned out to be a requisitioned hotel on the sea front, which, efficiently stripped of every peacetime comfort, was now a cold and desolate barracks. When we had been fed, 2 new sheepdogs formed us into a line outside the quartermaster's store to be issued with our uniform. Some of the Kunchis had not bargained for a military uniform, and the thought of it was so repugnant to them they refused point blank to accept it, let alone wear it. After a certain amount of shouting and argument, the military police took these men away and they were not seen again. I do not know what became of them, but it was generally assumed they would end up in a civil prison unless they changed their minds. After I had been given the coarse, scratchy underwear, the khaki battle dress, the heavy boots and the rest of the gear which made up my kit, I was shown where to sleep and then ordered to change into my new gear. My bedroom was now a large, shared dormitory lined with double-tiered bunks, which looked identical to those I had seen in the London Underground. As I dumped my kit on a top bunk, I noticed a large young man sitting on the lower bunk with tears streaming down his face. I felt pretty grim myself, but I tried to cheer him up as best I could. Finally, I managed to coax him to change into his uniform as one of the sheepdogs had ordered us to do. When we had both donned our new clothes, we looked at each other and burst out laughing. His uniform was as tight as a sausage skin, while mine was several sizes too big and hung on me with a scarecrow effect. We laughed so hard at each other that both of us forgot our miseries. My new friend's name was Ernie, and he was a London cockney who had been living more by his wits than by honest toil, a fact he told me with some pride, adding that he was pretty good at avoiding work or any other kind of unpleasantness. I soon found this was no idle boast. He was more than pretty good at it, he was an expert. What I hated more than anything during my training course at Ilfracombe was the daily drill session on the sea front. I could do nothing correctly, I had 2 left feet, I was hopeless. Sergeant Jones, the old sweat who drilled us, grew scarlet in the face and his eyes bulged out of their sockets with sheer frustration as he bawled at me for my stupid mistakes. The harder I tried to do what he wanted, the more clumsy and awkward I became and the louder he bawled. To add to the misery of it, groups of civilians would gather to watch and their uninhibited laughter infuriated Sergeant Jones and humiliated me. After a while, I think Sergeant Jones came to believe I actually enjoyed being the local comic act, because he stopped bawling at me and simply put me on a charge whenever I did something idiotic. The charge was usually dumb insolence against which there is no defense. Sergeant Jones' change in tactics resulted in my spending so much time engaged in repetitive tasks, like peeling potatoes or cleaning, that I saw very little of the town while I was stationed there. Ernie was by no means a model soldier, but he always managed to avoid trouble or undue exertion, and he was always amply supplied with funds. Later I learned he made a useful little income selling black market ladies' stockings to the locals. But he was a good friend and he gave up many of his evenings to help me to peel mountains of potatoes or polish acres of floor. Shortly before the course ended, Ernie and I were strolling in the town when we spotted a cut-price photographer's, so we decided to have our pictures taken. When we got them, they were truly dreadful. I do not know which of us looked worse. I tore up mine on the spot except for one copy which I sent to Edith, hoping it would at least make her laugh. At last the course was over and, in theory at any rate, we had been licked into some kind of military shape. We were given travel warrants and 7 days leave and told to report back to a camp on the Welsh border. For my first night at home, Edith had arranged a sitting of our home circle, but it had hardly begun before the siren wailed and a heavy air raid was soon in full swing. One or two members of the circle wondered if we should take cover and postpone the sitting, but the suggestion had no sooner been made than Mickey came through to veto it. He told us nothing whatsoever would happen to our house and asked us to continue the séance. We did as Mickey asked, but the raid got worse and worse until the whole house rocked on its foundations as a particularly heavy bomb fell uncomfortably close. Mickey at once returned to speak to us and told us a landmine had fallen a few streets from us and many people had been killed. He went on to say that hundreds of spirit people were already at the scene of the disaster to help the victims over the border between this life and the next, and to explain to them the fact of their physical death and their continuing life in the other world. Mickey is normally cheerful, irrepressible and quick at repartee, but that evening he talked to us very seriously and as he talked, his usual treble boy's voice changed its timbre and became more adult, more cultured and more resonant. The subject of Mickey's discourse was the enormous effort being made by the spirit world to ensure no victim of the war, whatever his nationality, creed or state of mind, should be left to cling to the earth because of ignorance of the life to come. He told us thousands upon thousands of spirit people have made it their task to go wherever the need arose to guide the newly dead, who were in a state of bewilderment, to their place in the next life. Later that evening, while the others were drinking ration tea and eating wartime sandwiches, I went upstairs to fetch a cardigan for Edith. On Edith's bedside table I noticed the appalling photograph I had sent to her from Ilfracombe. Now it was in a silver frame. The thought that Edith cherished this dreadful picture touched me deeply. I made up my mind to try again to persuade her to marry me. As we washed up in the kitchen after our guests had gone, I begged her to be my wife. She produced all the old arguments I had heard so often before, but I put my hand over her lips to stop her. "It's you I want to marry," I told her, "no one else will do." 2 days later we were married at the local registry office and the first thing we did after the simple little ceremony was to send Owen a telegram with the news. His simple reply read, "Dearest idiots, news long overdue, so glad. Owen." What remained of my leave we spent happily together at home. Very few of the men I had trained with at Ilfracombe had been posted to my new camp, but I was glad to find Ernie there when I arrived. Our work was laying a new railway track and from 8 in the morning until nightfall we carried and laid the heavy sleepers. It was hard, tough work, but once my unaccustomed muscles were limbered up I rather enjoyed working out in the fresh air and daylight, as a change from years of sitting passively in a darkened room to earn my living. Also, thankfully, there was no time for drill sessions in this busy workers' camp. As far as Ernie was concerned, hard labor under the eye of a sergeant who was alert to pounce on slackers was an outrage. "It's a bloomin' liberty," he would complain angrily. "I'm a bloke what sees jobs get done. I don't do 'em myself. I got brains, see. They've got a nerve." Ernie was never one to suffer passively and he set his undoubted talents to work to somehow achieve a transfer to a less obnoxious job. He attended so many sick parades, for which he carefully swatted up on medical symptoms at the local library, and once or twice he fainted so realistically at work that the harassed and aging medical officer eventually gave in and put him on light duties. Ernie was then given a job in the camp kitchen and every morning thereafter, lounging gracefully in the doorway of the kitchen hut, he would make a point of watching as our sergeant marched us out to work on the railway. The men I worked with were pacifists for different reasons. The majority of them were sincere and had registered from a religious conviction of one kind or another. Some were shirkers who simply wanted to avoid war service, particularly duty overseas. Others had political views which made them regard the war as exploitation of the workers, or so they said. A very small number were pure cranks, and their ingrown egos and passionate illogicalities made them hard to take. I remember one man, a member of the Plymouth Brethren, who was horror-stricken when he learned I was not only a spiritualist, but a medium too. He refused to speak to me or to come within yards of me because he said I was of the devil. In our dormitory hut he would ostentatiously kneel beside his bunk and pray aloud to be delivered from the snares of Satan's servant until the other men in the hut threw boots, brushes or anything they could lay their hands on, to make him shut up. After a few nights he disappeared from our hut altogether and peace reigned once more. Later we learned he had been sleeping in one of the outhouses until he had been discovered by a sergeant and reported to the commanding officer. When the CO questioned him about his curious behavior, the soldier said he would rather die than sleep in the same hut as a necromancer, and he got so overexcited about it that the CO, a humane man, told him he would be moved to another dormitory. For a time we heard no more of our brother until one day at pay parade he dramatically tore up the paper money and tossed away the silver he had just been given as his pay, shouting that he would not take blood money. This caused a sensation and one or two fingers got badly trampled in the scrum around his discarded coins. Soon afterwards the brother was discharged from the army on psychiatric grounds and was seen no more. I felt sorry for him, because he was sincere in his beliefs and the strain of army life must have turned his brain, but Ernie was convinced the brother had hit upon a brilliant way to work his ticket and he was absolutely furious he had not thought of it first. As a result of this episode I received a fair amount of good-humored ridicule about spiritualism and I was frequently challenged to produce a spirit. It was all meant as fun but it was becoming repetitious and tiresome. So one night after lights out in our dormitory hut, when the pestering started up again, I asked the men to relax and lie quietly in their bunks and perhaps someone might come to talk to them. After a few stifled giggles and embarrassed coughs, the men lay quietly and after a few minutes Mickey began to speak. He spoke to most of the men individually and gave them help and advice about various problems, of which I was unaware. Finally he introduced the sister of one of them who had passed on only a few weeks previously. The man and his dear sister were having a personal talk when one of the sergeants suddenly hammered on the door of our hut and then he barged in, putting on the light as he did so, and our séance ended very abruptly. This caused the ectoplasm, which the other side had taken from me to make the artificial larynx through which the voices speak, to rush back into my body and I felt as though I had been kicked in the solar plexus. As I lay winded and retching, I remembered the warning Noah Zerdin had given me years before in the little cafe in Watford. For the first time in the practice of my mediumship I knew exactly what he meant. When I had recovered and the sergeant had gone, the soldier who had been talking to his sister told the other men that he had not told a soul in the camp he had a sister, living or dead. There was no more ridicule and I was often asked to give another séance in our dormitory but, fearing another kick in the midriff, I never did. Long before we had finished our railway track, in the usual antic manner of the army a number of men, including Ernie and me, were transferred to a camp near Salisbury, where the work consisted of making a road near a big RAF station. Road making is every bit as strenuous as laying a railway track, but I preferred the new camp. I was often able to get home on weekend leave when I would give a group sitting on Saturday evening to people chosen by Edith as being in special need of my help. I was happy to carry on with my real work even if it was only in a small and restricted way. For the first time since I had been in the army I met a fellow spiritualist at the new camp. With several men I had been detailed to clear away a broken road surface and we were working in the nerve-wracking vicinity of a pneumatic drill. Suddenly I became clairvoyantly aware of an elderly man standing close to one of the men working with me. The spirit man was as clear and as lifelike as the soldier whose attention he was trying to attract. In spite of the hideous distraction of the drill, I became aware that the spirit wanted the soldier to know that he regretted his opposition to something. I felt uneasy about passing on this message since, for all I knew, the soldier might share the same religious view as the fanatic from the other camp. Then the drill ceased its exacerbating din and for a few seconds my rapport with the elderly spirit man grew, until I knew beyond any doubt that he wanted to tell his son he was sorry he had been so antagonistic to his interest in spiritualism, but he knew better now. I had no reason to hesitate any longer, and as soon as the pneumatic drill paused again I told the soldier what I had clairvoyantly seen and heard. He introduced himself as Hubert Fenimore and said he recognized the description of his late father as an accurate one. He also confirmed that his father had been bitterly opposed to spiritualism and there had been some ill feeling between them on this account. Hubert was deeply touched that his father had made the effort to contact him through me in order to say he was sorry. We became friends and enjoyed many talks about our mutual interest in psychic matters. In fact, Hubert and his wife are good friends of mine to this day. The transfer from Shrewsbury suited me, but it did not please my friend Ernie at all. No longer was he able to watch the rest of us march out for a day's labor from the shelter of a comfortable job. Ernie was now one of the marchers, and road making appealed to him no more than laying railway sleepers. He began his sick parade routine again and threw one or two impressive feints, but the new medical officer was neither as aged nor as gullible as the old one, and he refused to certify Ernie as too fragile to work on the road, in spite of all the symptoms Ernie produced for him. After the failure of his sick parade ploy, Ernie became very friendly with some members of an esoteric religious sect who used to meet in the evenings to read the Bible and sing hymns. Ernie attended these meetings and soon he was seldom to be seen without a Bible under his arm. One night over a cup of coffee in the Narfi, Ernie told me with great solemnity that he had been saved and, while he had no wish to hurt me, he said he could no longer be the friend of a man who had given his soul to the devil. This was all familiar ground and I shook my head at him. "It won't work, Ernie," I said. "Not so soon after the last one. Besides, Sergeant Grant was at Shrewsbury when it happened." Ernie grinned disarmingly. "I'd forgotten about Grant," he said. "Oh, well. I'll have to try and think of something else." I suggested he might try resigning himself to the inevitable and he gave me a scathing look. "I'm getting out of this place if it's the last thing I do," he said. "I'm in the prime of life and I'm sweating for 2 shillings a day. It's ludicrous, that's what it is. In the city, if you knock off a few cases of gin or something, they queue up for it. Fruidiaresis negation ver a bottle, I'm telling you." Ernie thumbed briskly through an imaginary wad of fivers and kissed his fingers rapturously. He was a scoundrel, but he was also kind, generous and lovable, and I valued his friendship, so I bought him a beer and wished him a luck. Owen was now on active service with a bomber squadron and Edith's letters were full of fears for him. I thought she would not be able to bear it if anything happened to Owen. The other children from her first marriage had left home long ago to marry and lead their own lives, and though the bond between them and Edith was strong, Owen was her youngest and her best loved child. One morning I got a telegram to say he was wounded and in hospital near Canterbury. I was given 72 hours leave to go and be with my wife. We sat on a bench outside Owen's ward in the hospital and waited for a doctor to come. We knew only that his aircraft had been badly hit by anti-aircraft fire over Germany and he had barely managed to limp home where he had crash-landed. We had no idea how badly he was hurt or even if he would live or die. We waited for an hour, 2 hours, and still no doctor came. I knew the hell Edith must be going through and I got very angry about what seemed like torture by the uncaring hospital staff. I stood up ready to demand someone's attention for my wife, but Edith gently pulled me back. "There are so many anxious people, some of us must wait," she said. I had underestimated my wife, she really was gold all the way through. At last the doctor came and he was young and harassed and very weary. Owen had got off lightly, although his sergeant had been killed. There were no broken bones, but he had many superficial cuts, bruises and a bad concussion. "We'll have him back with his squadron in less than a month," said the young doctor cheerfully. I saw the quiver of Edith's lip, but she managed a smile and said, "That will please him, I know." When I got back to camp, Ernie was nowhere to be seen. I asked everyone I saw what had happened to him and finally I was told he had been sent to a psychiatric unit. It appeared that Ernie had bleached his hair one night while the rest of the men in his hut were sleeping, and next morning he appeared to them all, to their astonished gaze, as a radiant blonde. He had then rushed around the camp screeching in a high falsetto voice that he could not sleep another night in a hut with all those lovely men or he would go crazy. Efforts to calm him down had been met with either hysterical laughter or floods of tears, until finally two medical orderlies had taken him off in a jeep to a destination loosely described as the bin. It was obvious to me this was a new and somewhat desperate attempt of Ernie's to work his ticket, but I have no idea whether his ploy succeeded, because none of us saw Ernie again. When the new road was almost finished, a notice went up on the camp bulletin board asking for volunteers for bomb disposal duties. It was one of the elementary precepts of army life never to volunteer for anything whatsoever, and this invitation to play about with live bombs was regarded as a joke in extremely poor taste. I have to say that for a long time I passed that bulletin board daily without experiencing even the smallest urge to inscribe my name in the space thoughtfully provided for the signatures of volunteers. This space remained totally blank for many weeks, but a day came when I realized with a shock of annoyance that I was beginning to feel a sense of personal guilt about this unanswered appeal. I tried to argue myself out of this and my logic was impeccable, but the feeling persisted and began seriously to disturb me. I took to averting my eyes when I had to pass the bulletin board, then I started to make detours to avoid it altogether, but I could not rid myself of the nagging sense of guilt. I was led to question whether my contribution to the war effort was enough. Other men in their thousands were risking life and limb daily while I was making a road. Granted, the road was required for military purposes, but I lived and worked in conditions considerably less dangerous than those of civilians in any of the big towns or cities. Air raids were few and far between in the Wiltshire wilds where our camp was located. One morning when I was making my usual detour to avoid the notice board, I stopped in my tracks and without making any conscious decision to do so, I turned right around and walked firmly back towards it. Without a second thought I wrote my name in the space provided, and the moment it was done I was at peace with myself again. In due course I was posted to a unit stationed in a large house in a residential part of Cardiff, where I learned how to defuse unexploded bombs and render them harmless. Every man in this unit had volunteered to do this dangerous job, and whether it was because we all faced the same dangers or because of a fortuitous blending of personalities, there was great comradeship between us. In my bomb disposal days I encountered none of the bigotry which had condemned me out of hand because I was a spiritualist medium. I was accepted as the person I was and for my part in the work of the unit. When first I arrived I had been appalled to find that our commanding officer was very keen on drill and parades and military discipline. It did not take me long to realize that discipline and trained coordination were the very factors on which our lives would depend when we became an operational unit. I tried very hard to overcome my parade ground apathy and eventually I became a passable soldier. I made a number of friends in Cardiff who were kind enough to invite me to their homes in my free time, and it was bliss to be in the atmosphere of a home again, even though it was not my own. When the local spiritualist church learned of my identity I was inundated with requests for sittings. I did what I could in my free time and it was a joy to experience again the satisfaction of giving help and reassurance to those in need of it. By the time our unit was operational, defusing a bomb was a disciplined routine. It had become second nature to do the right thing in the right way. Certainly we never lost our healthy respect for the bombs we handled, but the precision with which the squad worked together and our total confidence in each other minimized both risk and nervous strain. After many months the number of bombs our unit was called on to handle dwindled to vanishing point and we became idle and rather bored, missing the periodic stimulus of danger. There were rumors we were about to be disbanded and eventually we were invited to volunteer for other forms of service, because our training had been overtaken by new types of bombs and as a disposal unit we were obsolete. Soon I was on my way to London for a 3-month course in typing, shorthand and office routine. As the train rushed through the countryside I indulged in a daydream. In my imagination there was a general, who was not unlike the victor of El Alamein, General Montgomery, and he was studying a map. Sometimes he sat at an imposing desk, at other times he was roughing it in a caravan, but wherever he was surrounded by officers who wore red tabs on their uniforms. Impatiently he waved the officers away.